Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Hey, can somebody tell me what they were putting in the water back in the 70s? They said it was just fluoride, but I mean, come on. Have you looked at the stuff that we bought in the record stores back then? I mean, one novelty song after another made its way onto the pop charts. Remember The Streak?
Here it comes!
Boogity, boogity.
Here it goes!
Boogity, boogity.
And he ain't wearing no clothes!
Oh, yes, they call him The Streak!
That was a hit. And what about the novelty song about boxer Muhammad Ali?
He knows how to talk, and he knows how to fight, and all the contenders were beat out of sight. Sing Muhammad, Muhammad Ali, he floats like...
That was a hit, too. So was Convoy, an ode to CB radios and avoiding speeding tickets.
We is heading for Bear on I-10, about a mile out of Shaky Town. I says, Pigpen, this here's a rubber duck, and I'm about to put the hammer down.
I mean, seriously, what were we thinking? It was like, hey, I've written a song about ballpoint pens. Great, we all want to buy copies. That's why we have our ongoing series called That Was a Hit, to try to make sense of songs that you'd never expect to be pop hits. Today, we tackle one of the 70s' biggest novelty hits.
Oh, ho, ho, ho.
As Kung Fu Fighting goes under the soundcheck microscope, find out how this politically incorrect, ha-infested song became a pop hit. It's coming up, and then we'll all take a deep, cleansing breath and listen back to a terrific in-studio performance from Pavement frontman Stephen Malkmus and his current band, The Jicks. Their latest album has a certain 70s flair. To begin, though, it's time for another recurring segment that we call Pick 3. It's our chance to invite a special guest to share a playlist of three favorite songs. And joining us today is author Philip Meyer. His recent novel called The Sun wound up on many Best of 2013 lists from the New York Times, USA Today, Chicago Tribune, Washington Post. It's just out in paperback, and Philip Meyer joins us now. Philip, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks, John.
So The Sun is, I mean, this is epic. It's like almost 200 years of American history seen through the prism of one family. Your first novel, American Rust, was no slouch in terms of, you know, subject matter, but was there like, did you feel the need to go epic, to go big for the second book?
Yeah, I think I did. American Rust was set in a small kind of dying steel town in western Pennsylvania. It was about the first generation of kids to grow up there after the mills had shut. I grew up in Baltimore, which was kind of a mix of a steel town, the huge auto industry. My neighborhood was a textile mill neighborhood, and those mills had closed about 10 years before we got there. You know, when you get to the 80s, late 70s, everyone's out of work.
Right.
So this first book, American Rust, was about the end of the American dream for a large portion of the middle class. For The Sun, I wanted it, and people thought this was depressing for some reason, I guess. So you wanted
to write something uplifting about race and the rush for oil and the end of the American West.
That's what I thought.
It's a laugh riot, Philip.
I know, Ralph. Really funny book. So the second book, I kind of wanted to take on the time when the country was still expanding and when there was a little bit more realistic that you could, you know, arrive on some part of the East Coast with no name and nothing and move west and kind of reinvent yourself. Once I got into the research, I realized the people who settled the country, the people who lived on the frontier, were not the sort of middle class, upper middle class, stable family type people that we sort of have been taught to think they were. Mm-hmm. These are the people who had nothing to lose. I mean, why else? The frontier was a combat zone, whether you're talking 1650 when it was just west of here, whether you're talking 1850 when it was going through Texas. You know, it basically looked like Iraq. You know, we the one group of people who were mm-hmm. Anglo were moving into the territory that had been lived in for 15,000 years by another group of people, various Native American tribes. And, you know, no one wants to give up their resources and land without a fight. So right. The frontier was an absolute combat zone.
And then you have a third group coming from the south.
Right. I mean, the Spanish were here 100 years before the English. Yeah. And we sort of conveniently forget that all, you know, the oldest cities are, you know, they're in New Mexico. I mean, we say, you know, Santa Fe is 500 years old, but it's nice to forget that because it doesn't fit in with the sort of pilgrim mentality.
Yeah, the idea of America as an eastern country that has gradually moved west,
yeah, exactly.
As opposed to something southwestern that has, you know, seen lots of invasions from different
absolutely.
Places.
And then the French, of course. I mean, and it's so researching this book and writing it just showed me sort of how flawed all these different mythologies were. I wanted to make a family and make characters that would allow me to show that without ever saying it out loud, you know?
So who is the son? Because we're following Eli, who's sort of the patriarch of the family.
Yeah.
We do see Peter,
yeah.
his son, through his diaries.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then we have Jeannie, who is Peter's
granddaughter. Yeah, yeah.
And who is, you know, it's 2012. She's a very modern person. I mean, she's ancient, and
sure.
she's lying on the floor dying. And, but yeah, so who's the son?
Well, so they all are.
Even Jeannie.
And Jeannie, of course, trying to play with the notion of the idea that the firstborn son would inherit everything and continue the family. This, in Jeannie's case, is not true at
yeah.
all. Her older brothers are sort of useless, dilettante, you know, rich kids, and she's the one who has to carry the name forward and kind of save the family and save the fortune.
We're speaking with Philip Meyer, author of the novel The Son, an epic family drama set in Texas, beginning in really in the 1840s when
exactly.
His family is mostly wiped out and he's kidnapped by the Comanches. There's not a lot of music in this book. Are you? I would have assumed that there was lots of, you know, that people would, you know, think of Little House on the Prairie, the dad with his fiddle, you know, that sort of thing happened a lot. Was it difficult? I mean, you're a music person, right? You're
yeah,
a music fan. Was
for
it difficult
sure.
to kind of, you know, put that off to the side for a while?
I think so. The crucial thing when you're making any sort of art is that it's in some way fundamentally based in reality, or at least a reality that could exist. And so the McCullough family actually does, you know, they have a sort of primitive piano that the you know, the mother's transported into the frontier. But when you're trying to shoehorn your own tastes into things, people can always smell it. It always comes out seeming false. And so I think I'm quite nervous about that stuff. And every time, I write a sentence in which I think, God, that sentence is brilliant, this character is sort of explaining the state of America exactly as it is, I always delete it because I'm always sort of so worried about characters in the book, people in the book saying things that I believe that they wouldn't necessarily, you know, believe.
Mm. So 18th century piano, you're not likely to hear somebody banging out The Clash.
if only. Yeah.
So your pick three starts with The Clash and actually a track from London Calling. You would have been like 6 when this album
yeah,
came
sure.
out.
Yeah.
So how and when did you come to The Clash?
I guess probably the end of middle school, probably the first year of high school, which for me would have been 1988, you know.
Right.
So this was just one of these things that you understand somehow the intent or the tone or the emotion before you understand what the song is actually about. And this song always moved me. It was one of these things that I listened to on repeat. I would, this is back when I still listened to records. Now it's hip to do that. Before, it was actually really annoying. So because you had to, you know, lift up the needle and
yep.
play the song again, lift up the needle. And I would do this like 30
I remember
times
how
in a
records
row.
Work. Yes.
For our listeners who don't.
So the song is Guns of Brixton. So
yeah.
did you, how long were you listening to this before you actually had the light bulb moments that, oh, that's what that song's about?
You know, it probably was you know, 6 months, a year. I mean, quite a long time, because of course there was no internet then, and you had to figure out lyrics on your own and the sort of hilarious interpretations, you know, of lyrics that we all would have back in those days. And I realized, okay, you know, this is about people who are, in a way, like the people I grew up with. They're oppressed. This is the beginning of Thatcherism. You know, everyone in the north of England is losing their jobs. The people in the cities are feeling the squeeze as well. All the social services are being cut, and these people are going to lash out at whomever they can.
Yeah. Right, which tended to be blacks and Caribbeans. And
absolutely, yeah.
So there is that sort of reggae kind of flavor to the song.
For sure, yeah.
From The Clash, from their classic 2-LP set, London Calling, this is Guns of Brixton.
When they kick at your front door, how you gonna come? Put your hands on your head or on the trigger of your gun.
Guns of Brixton, a classic from The Clash, from their album London Calling, released in 79. Philip Meyer, picking three for us, sharing his pick three playlist with us in the Soundcheck studio. He is the author of the book The Sun, and before that, American Rust, a Guggenheim fellow as well, and my guest here in the Soundcheck studio. The only band that matters. That's what we called them for a number of years.
It still feels that way.
Yeah. So the Clash, they were sort of led by Joe Strummer. They were very clearly socially conscious, socially
sure.
aware,
yeah.
you know, race relations. A lot of the themes that, you know, are part and parcel of The Sun.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that stuff's always concerned me. I've always been concerned just with the way systems work. How do these sort of social structures work? Who puts them in place?
Who questions them?
Who questions them? Who actively fights for them? And I've always had a sense, which is reinforced after I spent a couple of years on Wall Street, that none of this was – nothing is really accidental, even though the powers that be want you to believe it is.
Yeah.
You know, of course, it's all intentional.
What did you do on Wall Street?
I was a derivatives trader.
And how'd that work out for you?
That I made it a couple years and then and I had to pull out. Yeah, I realized I was an artist. So I grew up in this blue-collar neighborhood in Baltimore, and my parents were artists and kind of hippie intellectual types. We never had any money, and it was just, you know, there's some kids, when you come from that environment, you sort of accept it, and there are
yeah.
other people. I hated being poor. And so I was a bit of a delinquent, dropped out of high school. Standard American redemption story. But I drop out when I'm 16, get a GED. Early 20s, decide to go to college. Mid 20s, get into an Ivy League school, kind of through the back door, basically as a transfer student, and graduate when I'm 25 with a degree from Cornell and my GED, and get a job on Wall Street as a trader, thinking, okay, this is the American dream. I'm living it.
Have you seen Wolf of Wall Street?
I have, and it's very accurate. I mean, it's not. It's, I mean, it's not. No, none of that stuff is exaggerated. Actually, I certainly began to have questions about, you know, which side I sort of belonged to, and I'd come from this and seen all these people growing up with nothing, who were in many cases were just as smart or smarter than the guys I was working with on Wall Street. But, you know, the guys that work, most people who come here to work on Wall Street, they come from money and good families. And I began to see, okay, this is the difference. It's not that they work harder. It's just what you come from
yeah.
kind of determines your future.
It's interesting, you know, you talk about trying to figure out which side you're on because, you know, one of the interesting things about the main characters that we follow in The Sun is you're not really sure in terms of the social order which side they're on, you know, whether they're
sure.
within it,
yeah.
whether they're sort of a part of it without knowing, whether they're actively pushing against it. You know, sometimes what they think they're doing is in fact not what they think they're doing.
For sure. I mean, especially on the frontier, it's quite common for people to – you'd end up fighting for this group and then you'd be captured by one Indian tribe and then traded or sold to another Indian tribe. It was just – there was a fluidity to sides that to us – would seem most like something that would be recognizable from a sort of civil war. Yeah. You'd go from one side to another. But on the frontier, because it basically was a combat zone, there was no time and it was peaceful. The frontier was never peaceful. That sort of flipping was fairly constant, and this idea of a sort of coherent national identity and sort of us being on this side or this side, that's new. You know, that really began, you know, the 1890.
And even who's good and who's bad. I mean, Eli is a very likable character, but he does some horrible things.
Sure. And I think hopefully one of the questions the book is asking is at what point does the need for survival and sort of might being required just to protect your family and make it through the today or tonight turn into might makes right? Yeah. At what point does power save you? And at what point does power completely corrupt you?
Philip Meyer sharing a Pick 3 playlist with us on Soundcheck. And the second song we're going to play is from the Dropkick Murphys. Now, this is an arrangement of an old Union song.
For sure.
That does try to make that distinction very clear, that this group of people is absolutely right, that group of people is absolutely wrong.
Sure. And so this song was written by a lady whose husband was a union organizer during the Harlan County Wars in Kentucky.
So this would be the early 30s.
Correct. Yeah. So these things went on for – they were trying to sort of unionize this part, these coal mines, for about 10 years. And it was written – the sheriff was completely in the pockets of the mine owners. Mm-hmm. And they were basically shooting people whenever they felt like it. So they came into her house looking to execute her husband. Who managed to barely escape. They roughed her up, roughed her kids up, trashed her house. And after they left, she basically wrote this song. And it was covered by Pete Seeger and a bunch of other people. It's been covered by a million people. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, I like this, the Dropkick Murphys version. It was the first version I heard, and I heard it as I was thinking about leaving Wall Street. I mean, I'm not sure it was the major contributor to my choice, but it certainly made me think because, you know, when you come from, you know, even though, again, my parents were sort of educated intellectuals, when you grow up among the sort of working class and you're surrounded by the wealthy, there's a sense of schizophrenia you feel basically every day.
Cover of an old Union song from the Dropkick Murphys, the Celtic punk band from Massachusetts. Which side are you on? From their 2001 record, Sing Loud, Sing Proud. Philip Meyer, the author with me on Soundcheck, sharing his Pick 3 playlist. The Sun is now out in paperback, and a TV series is in the works?
Yeah, it is. Some friends of mine and I are hopefully going to write and produce it and run the show. And so at a bunch of...
Are you thinking
negotiations are going on?
Are you thinking miniseries or something more extensive?
We were. In fact, we went into all these very prissy Hollywood meetings a couple weeks ago thinking it was a miniseries, but the Sun ended up being about 600 pages in print. Mm-hmm. There are at least 4,000 or 5,000 good pages of material that I left out because it was just so much.
Well, you did so much research.
Oh, it was you're covering 175 years of pretty eventful history. So, I read about 350 books and I kind of learned how to track animals and learned how to live on the plains.
Did you drink buffalo blood?
I did, yeah. I drank a cup of warm buffalo blood, which not actually intending to, but I'd gone to a buffalo ranch.
Wait a minute, you accidentally drank?
Well, no, it was a sort of a spur of the moment decision. Let's say it was not a planned out thing. But this is the animal that was the largest herbivore in North America. All the plains Indian tribes depended on it, and I thought, okay, there's no way you can write about Native Americans at this time period without understanding the animal, how it smells, how it tastes, and not after it comes off the grill of your steakhouse, but actually as it's being butchered.
All right, so all this research going into the book called The Sun, and Philip Meyer with us here in the Soundcheck studio. Before we wrap up here, I do have to ask you, you referred to hippie parents before. Maybe that's going to be the answer here. But your first name, I have never seen Philip spelled P-H-I-L-I-P-P.
Yes, that is the old German spelling. My parents named me after C.P.E. Bach.
And so, Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach.
Exactly. Yeah. So, when I was in Germany and Switzerland doing my evil work for this investment book, I saw it was quite common to see Philip spelled that way.
Really?
It's sort of like Philippe. You know, it's like the French spelling minus the E.
Right.
But it's cursed me my entire life. It was spelled wrong on my passport for a while. And now that these books are in print, of course, it's spelled correctly everywhere. But this is the first time. Very exciting.
All right. So our Pick 3 playlist brings us back to The Clash. A few years later, the album Combat Rock. And you picked the song Straight to Hell. What about this? I mean, this is sort of a family drama, isn't it?
Oh, sure. I mean, so this is another one of these things in which, you know, the way music works and the way art works is that, you know, it hopefully moves you emotionally first. Actually, it has to. It's almost like love in this way, in which you have this feeling and you know something's important and a song is important to you, even though you might not, and you probably don't understand the meaning at first. This is another thing, a song I found quite compelling. And then as I sort of began to listen to and dissect the lyrics, I realized, okay, again, this is about the loss of steel mill jobs in England and the sort of, again, sort of deindustrialization that I was watching happen in my own neighborhood. And then the sort of the leftovers and the sort of war orphans from Vietnam, and then a sort of a general statement on the plight of immigrants all over the place, people who are sort of left between borders and left without a home.
So the song is Straight to Hell from The Clash, from their album Combat Rock, picked for us by Philip Meyer, whose latest novel, The Sun, is now out in paperback. Philip, it's been great fun talking to you. Thanks very much.
As railhead towns feel the steel mills rust, water froze in the generation. Clear as winter ice, this is your paradise. There ain't no need for ya. There ain't no need for ya. Go straight to hell, boys. Go straight to hell, boys.
Up next, there's no debating that Kung Fu Fighting is a weird song. It's the latest song to go under the microscope in our series, That Was a Hit. This is Soundcheck.
And now, Soundcheck looks back at the pop charts of yesteryear and asks,
That was a hit?
Everybody was kung fu fighting.
They're coming to take me away, haha.
Time now for another installment of That Was a Hit, our series about baffling chart success. Today, we look back at one of the biggies. In fact, it's one of the songs that we excerpt in our theme song. You heard it just a moment ago. And that is Kung Fu Fighting by Carl Douglas. And joining us once again is Chris Melanfi, pop chart analyst and contributor to NPR Music, Slate, and Pitchfork. Hey, Chris.
How you doing, John?
Good. How big a hit was this thing?
This was a pretty enormous hit. If you were alive in 1974 and listening to a radio either here or in the UK, guaranteed you heard this song.
Like daily.
Oh, heck yeah. Yeah. And 74 is like the early days of popular disco, right? Like disco has already been in clubs for a while, but it's just starting to really cross over. This is even before The Hustle. It's, I believe, the same year as Rock the Boat by the Hughes Corporation. This is a fairly early club-oriented 70s hit. And in America, at least, it's totally a one-hit wonder for Carl Douglas.
Let's hear a little bit of the song Kung Fu Fighting by Carl Douglas.
Everybody was Kung Fu Fighting.
but they fought with expert timing. There were funky China men from funky Chinatown. They were chopping them up, they were chopping them down. It's an ancient Chinese art, and everybody knew their part. From a fainting to a slip and a kicking from the hip, everybody was kung fu fighting.
Carl Douglas and Kung Fu Fighting. That was a behemoth in 1974, early
Definitely.
75. Why?
I want to say that Carl Douglas was catching a wave mm-hmm. at a perfect moment. The kung fu craze, if you can call it that, was absolutely ascendant by 1974-75. You know, the David Carradine TV show Kung Fu was in, I believe, its third season at this point,
mm-hmm.
and a pretty big hit. Bruce Lee, of course, famously died tragically the year before in 73, just as his movie Enter the Dragon was about to be released. And that movie, in a way, his death became made him a legend. Enter the Dragon made tens of millions of dollars worldwide. So Kung Fu was absolutely at its apex. Douglas himself was kind of channeling that when he wrote the song. He co-wrote it with a producer who goes by the name Bidu. He is of Indian descent. Carl Douglas is of Jamaican descent. And we'll talk about that later because that gives him some interesting status on the U.S. charts. And Douglas actually spent most of his later years in England. So he was living mm-hmm. in England, recording in England. He had had a couple of British groups in the 60s. And then as he tells the story, I had to look this up in one of the Billboard books. He was passing a club in Soho, not even a club. He claims it was like a pinball hall
uh-huh.
in Soho, in England, the English
the
Soho.
London Soho.
London
yeah.
Soho, exactly. And he saw a bunch of kids that were mock fighting in time with the record that was playing in the pinball club. And he said to his friend, "Damn, it looks like everybody's kung fu fighting." And at that moment, he said, "I heard it all in my head, melody line as well. I had to rush home and write it down." But that the story doesn't end there. This is one of my favorite asides to the song. This thing was never meant to be a frontline promoted hit. Douglas had befriended Bidu,
the producer,
a couple years earlier when they worked on a Richard Roundtree movie called Embassy. And Bidu, at the time, had a track that he was dying to get somebody to record. The track was called "I Just Want to Give You My Everything," and it was written by Larry Weiss, who later had a number one hit with Rhinestone Cowboy. So Larry Weiss is like a songsmith, and he's mm-hmm. written various things. Bidu wants to record this song, and he talks to Douglas, whom he's now worked with, and says, "Hey, do you want to go in and cut this track?" They book studio time, just a couple of hours. They've got, you know, all the backing musicians and everything. They record the Weiss track. And they've got like 10 minutes left of studio time. So Bidu...
And they need a B-side.
And they need a B-side. Exactly. Remember, kids, that and for those of you who don't know, you know, 45 RPM records, they had an A-side and they had a B-side. And the B-side was often an afterthought. And they needed a B-side. So Bidu turns to Douglas and says, "Do you have anything?" And he says, "Well, I've got this and I've got this. I've got these other lyrics I wrote for this goofy thing about kung fu fighting." And Bidu said, "Yeah, all right, we'll do that." And so lickety-split, in 10 minutes, they threw together a recording of this thing.
Here comes the big boss.
Hey, hey.
Let's get it on. We took a bow and made a stand. Started swaying with the hand. A sudden motion made me skip. Now we're into a brand new trip. Everybody was kung fu fighting.
Bidu brings the two tracks to Pye Records, P-Y-E, which is
right.
the label in England that they were signed to. And they play it for the A&R team and they said, "Uh-uh, that's the A-side.
That's the hit."
That's the hit. And again, don't forget, it's now, this is around spring of 1974. The kung fu fad is at full throttle. You can imagine they saw dollar signs
yep.
in their heads when they heard this track.
And then they would hear it again and again, because over the years it's been covered so many times, beginning with this 1976 version by Lloyd Parks.
Everybody was kung fu.
Joka pelätyn kung fun taitaa.
everybody is kung fu fighting. Your mind becomes fast as lightning. Although the future is a little bit frightening, little bit frightening. The light that you're riding.
Yeah, Chris, we could have gone on and on with that little medley of covers.
Was that last one CeeLo?
That is CeeLo Green and Jack Black.
Wow.
Doing Kung Fu Fighting in a version for the movie Fu Panda.
Of course.
But before that, we heard Frederick from Finland and Kung Fu Taistele, which is the Finnish version of Kung Fu Fighting.
My gosh.
Bus Stop from 1998, but featuring Carl Douglas, the original singer. And before that, Lloyd Parks from 1976, 2 years after the Carl Douglas original, in a kind of reggae version. Now, you mentioned Carl Douglas was originally from Jamaica.
Yes, and one interesting trivia detail is by going to number one on the American charts in December of 1974, believe it or not, he was the first artist of Jamaican descent to have a number one hit in America.
So he beat Bob Marley.
He beat Bob Marley. Bob Marley actually never had a number one hit.
Is that right? While he was alive. Yeah.
While he was alive, yeah. Exactly. But yeah, no, he beat everybody.
Chris Melanfi's with us for our series That Was a Hit, and every time we do that series, we play a little medley of songs, and one of them is Kung Fu Fighting, and so finally, we're getting around to actually talking about this, this genuine one-hit wonder. You know, you listen to it now, and early on in the song, the Funky Chinaman from Funky Chinatown, right. And that kind of clangs on the ear a little bit these days.
Yeah, and well, the trope that it uses, which is one of the most overused tropes in Western music to indicate something Asian, is what's called the Oriental riff. I did a little background research on this, actually.
The thing that goes...
Exactly. And I did a little research on this, and it actually is a Western invention. It dates back to the mid-19th century, and this thing recurs a lot. I can think of two top 40 hits from the early 80s that use it. I bet one of them you know right off the top of your head,
John. I would say The Vapors Turning Japanese.
Uh-huh, that's right. And I'll bet you know the other one, too.
Mm.
You'll kick yourself when I tell you. It's David Bowie.
Really?
China Girl.
Oh, China Girl, of course.
Yes. So both of those.
Not
hits.
In the original. Not in the Iggy
Correct.
Pop original.
Not in the Only Iggy Pop original. In the Let's Dance album cover, exactly.
All right. You're right. I'm kicking myself. So that's incorporated in it. So were there, you know, people saying, hey, you can't say Chinaman like that?
I don't think anybody was in 1974.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
I mean, the fact that this thing recurred through the 80s indicates that we are far more sensitive, rightfully, and politically correct when it comes to these things now.
And so Carl Douglas becomes a genuine one-hit wonder, not for lack of trying. What did he do next?
In England, he actually had a few more hits, none remotely as big. This was his last top 10 hit anywhere. In England, he managed a follow-up hit, which actually was a top 10 R&B hit here in America called Dance the Kung Fu. It missed the top 40 in America, hence he's pretty clearly a one-hit wonder. But on the R&B chart, it did make the top 10. In England, it made the top 30. He got two more top 20 hits in the late 70s, and then pretty much he was done.
So if you were paying attention, you might have heard his follow-up called Dance the Kung Fu. But nobody was paying attention, and so it wasn't a hit.
Can you say quickie follow-up?
Oh, my goodness. It's like it doesn't actually have the Oriental theme, but it's very close.
Right, and it's picking up the same trope, the same string arrangement. Yeah.
What this song needs is a few,
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, that's one of the best stories is that the producer said that we were in the studio and we were recording this so fast, Kung Fu Fighting, of course, that we just threw the huzz and ahs in just off the top of our heads. I mean, really, it's one of the most accidental hits of all time.
So will this song be with us forever? Will it be the constant subject of covers and remixes and samples?
As long as Kung Fu Panda is in movie theaters, I think it's got to come back. I can't imagine that it's going to die anytime soon. It is the hit referencing the martial arts of the last 50 years.
Chris Malanfi is a pop chart analyst and contributor to NPR Music, Slate, and Pitchfork, joins us regularly, especially for our series That Was a Hit, about surprising and even baffling chart success. Few are more baffling than Kung Fu Fighting by Carl Douglas. Chris, thanks very much.
Anytime, John.
Next, after the seminal indie band Pavement broke up in the late 90s, Stephen Malkmus, their frontman, put together a band called The Jicks. They join us to play songs from their latest album, next on Soundcheck.
I've been you. I've been everywhere you're going.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. You might not know this, but here in the radio world, there's a secret committee that decides what you can and can't say on the air. And this morning, I spent hours with this powerful cabal, haggling over the title of the newest album from Stephen Malkmus and the Jicks. The decision was murky and not exactly decisive, so I've decided I'm just going to go ahead and say it anyway. Wig out at Jagbags. Stephen Malkmus and the Jicks are here in our studio today to play a couple of songs off of Wig Out at Jagbags, including this one called Planetary Motion. Here's Stephen Malkmus and the Jicks, whose new album is called Wig Out at Jagbags, live on Soundcheck.
United the ocean to the children.
That's a live performance here in the Soundcheck studio from Stephen Malkmus and the Jicks, a song called Planetary Motion, performed by Stephen Malkmus on voice and guitar, with Mike Clark on guitar, Joanna Bolme playing the bass, and Jake Morris behind our drum kit. From the new album called Wig Out at Jagbag, Stephen, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thanks for having us. Second time.
Is it only the second time?
I think, well, maybe there was a time before. Last time you were talking, you were debating the merits of R.E.M.'s new album and how it would hold up.
That's right.
Do you remember that?
And you were just about to move to Berlin.
I did, and I went there.
And
there
you did
for
go
two
there.
Years.
How was that?
It's a really fun place. It's pretty fantastic. I mean, it got to be positive.
And kind of the sixth borough. I mean, when we were in Berlin, we did a week of shows there, and it just seemed like every other person was, like, fleeing high rents in New York. Lots of Americans.
It can. That's true. Maybe you're in Kreuzberg or
that's
Neukölln.
Right. Exactly.
Those are the areas where NYU students party through the night and drive you crazy, I think. It's a fun place. The parks are wonderful. It's great for kids.
Yeah.
Surprisingly, you wouldn't think that, right? Because you think maybe techno and NYU students and just huge Germans. But actually, the parks are just fantastic, and they have all these tax incentives for to make you breed.
Really?
Yeah, you get like €175 per child.
Wow. And you wrote most of this record there, right?
Well, lyrics, a lot of them.
Yeah.
We did them kind of – we were touring around – on the last critically acclaimed album, Mirror Traffic. And we were working on new songs because we play medium to small size venues, and our crowd is amenable to new things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not just there to see that, they didn't pay $120 to see the hits, you know.
Right.
They're there for everything. So we work on new songs on tour, and that, so half of it I would say we had before I even moved there.
Wow. So the album is called Wig Out at Jagbags. Now look, I'm a Brooklyn boy. We have a different word that ends in bag.
Yes.
But
you got it.
All right. So is that a Midwest term?
I think it is. My buddies from Chicago use it. Pittsburgh, though, I think it reaches as far as Western Pennsylvania. I mean, I have not done a study.
A Google search?
I've seen that, and it leads to different websites like Chicago White Sox fan boards and...
Really?
Yeah, where people are venting their spleen and talking too much, and then they say, like, quit being such a jagbag. But it's kind of lighthearted. It's not a... I don't think you... When you're called a jagbag, it's... You kind of... Or like, oh, I'm just, you know, I'm just being a little bit obnoxious. I'm not a bad person.
Right. Recently, we were talking about, you know, these so-called Dylanologists, the people who comb through Dylan's writings, his lyrics, you know, looking, trying mm-hmm. to parse what the different influences are. And listening to this new album, you know, if there were Malkmusologists, they'd have a field day with this record, it seems.
They could, you know. This is our street legal.
I mean, it seems like every song has allusions, references, riffs, you know, taken from earlier,
yeah,
earlier
man.
Types of music.
I mean, I could talk about that, or I could just, I'd rather just be compared to Dylan. I'd keep going that way. We're both Geminis and, you know, trailblazers and mysterious.
Uh-huh. And magpies of a sort.
Yeah, he's got more kids, though, than me. He's the original gangster of Malibu, too.
Yeah.
No, people don't talk about that. You think it's all about David Geffen, and it's not.
We're speaking with Stephen Malkmus about his new album called Wig Out
sort
at Jagbags. Sort of. But this next song, The Janitor Revealed, it's been driving me crazy all day. There is a mm-hmm. guitar lick here that is... I've known it since the 70s, I think. And
you guys might know Kinks. Is it Kinksy, or is there a
no,
riff in there?
I don't think it's...
Queen? Those little hammer-ons?
No. It's more of like an almost like an Allman Brothers-y sounding thing.
I know what you
They all know what I mean, but Steven doesn't. So
no.
go play the song, okay, and let's see what happens. The song is called The Janitor Revealed, a great title, from Stephen Malkmus and the Jicks. They're playing live here in the Soundcheck studio. The song appears on their latest album called Wig Out at Jag Bags, but this is a live performance on Soundcheck.
I'm ready.
I was up for just about anything, feeling hungry, heading to spring, and soon enough, you know, my time will come. We were put on this earth to shine, destined for greatness by design. The mental speed bumps you must navigate, the frigid shoulders interrupting fate. I often jump onto my future days. Applicable wealth is on display. Casual confidence to say. In a constant tizzy, cyberide, I'm busy. Won't you open up the door?
Is called The Janitor Revealed from the new album Wig Out at Jag Bags by Stephen Malkmus and the Jicks. That's a live performance by the band here in the studio. It's that lick that goes down, 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 down.
Yeah. Bum, 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 bum.
Down, 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 down. Except you don't go there. You go somewhere else. That's been driving me crazy. It's like Allman Brothers or one of those bands.
Aqualung.
No, that's it's not Aqualung.
Good.
Stephen Malkmus singing and playing guitar, Mike Clark playing our piano and guitar, and Joanna Balmy playing the bass, Jake Morris is playing the drums. They're all playing for us here in the Soundcheck studio. You want to do Independence Street?
That's true, I do.
Stephen Malkmus and the Jicks live in the studio.
Thank you.
your brandy, I can hardly sip your tea. I don't have no tea left for your candy, I'm just busy being me. Living in this shirt, everybody hurts, there's no central heat on Independent Street. I know that she's nothing but nothing, nothing but a lover girl. See the way she gives her when those kisses, she's everything you need and more. Sucking on a cert, that ain't no dessert, I cannot compete. On Independent Street, sip your tea. I don't have no tea left for your candy, I'm just busy being free. Living in this church, I just might convert, there's no way to
Stephen Malkmus and the Jicks, live on Soundcheck with a song called Independence Street, once again from their latest release called Wig Out at Jagbags. So, Stephen, you remember the last time you and the band were here? We were looking back at REM's career. They had just announced they were breaking up. We're doing a little more retrospection on the show coming up because it's obviously the 20th anniversary of the summer of 94, and a big anniversary for Pavement fans, because Crooked Rain turned 20 this year as well. So
yeah,
there was the Pavement reunion tour some years ago. Were you guys going to do anything around the 20th anniversary of Crooked Rain?
I don't think so. Yeah. We like 21 anyway. That's a more interesting year.
That's when the album can drink.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And like Matador had a giant celebration of itself in Las Vegas, and its artists,
right,
and its fans, and its culture at 21. So when it turns 21, I think it's good because you can, people want to talk about 20, you're like, no, 21, and then 23 just pops up, says Aleister Crowley or whatever. It's a good album, though. I guess it's, I'm happy that it's worthy of 2 decades of retrospect,
Yeah. Stephen Malkmus and the Jicks have been playing for us here in our New York studio. Their latest album is out now. It's called Wig Out at Jagbags. Stephen, great to see you again. Thanks for bringing the band back in.
Thanks for having us down.
Only a chariot could carry it across this void. I wouldn't jerry rig or candy coat your Latin.
This session with Stephen Malkmus and the Jicks first aired back in May. Explore our archive of live performances on soundcheck.org. And follow us on Twitter at Soundcheck or like us on Facebook to find out about upcoming performances in our studio.
On Monday, we'll revisit two of our favorite conversations from this year. First, Tori Amos returns to our studio to perform songs from her latest album, Unrepentant Geraldines. And she'll play an old favorite, too. And the classic album Doolittle by the Pixies turned 25 this year. We'll look back at a pivotal moment in the evolution of alternative rock. Soundcheck is a production of WNYC. Irene Trudell leads our engineering team with Paul Schneider, Bill O'Neill, and Jason Isaac. The show is produced by Katie Bishop, Dan O'Donnell, and Mike Katziff with Amy Pearl. Our executive producer is Joel Meyer. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.